Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the Voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for the Technology Report and This is America, coming up after As It Is.
Hello, and welcome to As It Is from VOA Learning English. I'm Christopher Cruz in Washington. Today on the program, we have an interesting look at the U.S. Congress and why it does what it does. This week, voters will decide who they want to represent them in the U.S. House and Senate. But many Americans say they don't know how the U.S. Congress operates. In Washington, D.C., some adults have been attending a class called Understanding Congress. We talk with the teacher, a former member of the House.
Well, Congress is big and it's complicated. And moreover, we have gone out of our way to make it mysterious.
Why Congress does what it does, today on As It Is from VOA. Americans are preparing to vote in midterm elections on Tuesday. Voters will choose among candidates for local and state government positions. They will also fill all 435 voting seats in the United States House of Representatives. And they will elect or re-elect one-third of the 100 members of the U.S. Senate. Senators serve six-year terms. House members are required to seek re-election every 2 years. In Washington, D.C., some adults have been attending a 10-week-long class called Understanding Congress. It is taught for 3 hours at night, once a week, at the Graduate School USA, near VOA's headquarters. Many of the students are federal employees. The grad school was once part of the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Michael Flanagan is teaching the Understanding Congress class. He served as a member of the House of Representatives for 1 2-year term in the 1980s. He and invited speakers tell the students about the workings of Congress and the legislative process. Students in the Understanding Congress class learn about formal and informal leadership and power politics, and about correct behavior, often called ethics. And they are taught how the two main political parties, the Republicans and the Democrats, try to reach their goals. Michael Flanagan tells his students that Congress is the first and most important branch of the U.S. government. He notes that when the nation was formed, Congress created the presidency and the court system. He says Congress is closer to the American people than the other two branches. At the end of the class, students visit the U.S. Capitol building to train to debate legislation. They will speak in the chamber of the U.S. House. Mr. Flanagan notes that as many as 10,000 bills are written during the House's 2-year term. He says only a few hundred of the proposals are approved. During that 2-year period, House members may vote more than 1,000 times. Members of the House and Senate often speak in a strange language. Some of their rules and traditions are centuries old. Some members of Congress appear to dislike one another and criticize their opponent's actions. But they still call each other friend and use expressions like the distinguished gentleman. Michael Flanagan says that if few Americans know or care what really happens in the House and Senate, Congress itself is partly to blame.
Well, Congress is big and it's complicated. And moreover, we have gone out of our way to make it mysterious.
But the former lawmaker says Congress is really not very difficult to understand. He says the reason voters know so little about it is because they are not taught much about it. He says American schools should do a better job of teaching how the country is governed.
People don't understand how their government works. It's all very big and mysterious, and it never does what I want it to do, and therefore it's wrong. And we really would do well to teach our kids and teach ourselves how this process works. There's nothing mysterious about it. Men and women of average intelligence and of average capacity manage the government and are elected to office, and it runs. And so I think if we demystified it, we'd have a better grasp of how it works, and then we would have more control over it.
Mr. Flanagan says being a member of Congress can be a difficult job. He says representatives and senators must put all their energy into their work. He says they often gain weight and suffer health problems during their time in office. They do not have much time for their families. The days are long. Lawmakers are always attending congressional hearings or meeting with voters, interest groups, reporters, and state and local officials, both in Washington and in their home state. They always seek to know what people in their home districts are thinking, and the amount of work they must complete is always growing. Many people members of Congress talk with are unhappy with the lawmakers and often criticize their work. But Michael Flanagan says serving in Congress is a chance to make history and affect people's lives in a positive way.
It's a tremendous job. You get to shape the future of the nation in some small way as one of the 535 participate in that process. You also get to do tremendous things for your district if you take that portion of your job seriously, which I did and most do. It's a parade of really getting to get the things that you want done, you know, and there's a great satisfaction that comes with that in any walk of life. Unfortunately, it comes at a price of being always available. And when you're serving 750,000 people in some corner of some state, there's a lot of demands on your time that you don't view as important, but they do, and they're the boss. So you have to give up vast amounts of your time.
He adds that being a member of the House or Senate is a wonderful job and a horrible life. And he says much of the activity of Congress is for political, not legislative purposes. He calls it campaigning by legislation. Mr. Flanagan says because House members represent so many people, it is impossible to represent their beliefs. 50 years ago, each congressional district had about half as many people as it does now. And the country was less diverse, with a smaller number of ethnic, cultural, or religious groups. That made it easier for a lawmaker to represent his or her district. Although the job can be difficult, many Americans want to serve in Congress. And once they are in office, few are defeated for re-election. Political experts say at least 90% of those who seek re-election to the House and Senate will win. That's our program for today. I hope it has helped you learn everyday American English. And I hope you have learned something interesting about the United States Congress. I'm Christopher Cruz. I invite you to join us again tomorrow at this same time for another edition of As It Is, here on the Voice of America.
The Technology Report is next, followed by This Is America. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Technology Report. Testing new drugs for safety and effectiveness is a costly process in the United States. It also can take a lot of time. Some scientists are now designing silicon computer chips that act like human organs. The scientists think they have found a way to make the process faster and more economical. The silicon chips are smaller than a child's hand. Each one has living cells that act and react like a human organ. The chips are being created as part of a program to test the safety of drug compounds. It is called the Tissue Chip for Drug Screening Program. It is a project of the U.S. National Center for Advancing Translational Sciences, or NCATS. Danilo Tagle is the center's associate director. He says a three-dimensional computer chip can be designed to act like a human lung. He describes how such a device would operate.
In that case, it would be cells representing the air sacs that would be represented on this bioengineered devices, and then allowing it to breathe and expand and be able to take in air, take in fluids, just like a normal lung would.
Some computer chips contain very small models of the human digestive system. They copy the real function or duties of the human stomach and intestine, moving when breaking down food. Drugs are added to the tiny organs for testing through instruments known as microtubes. Experiments with the tissue chips have produced more detailed information than tests using animal or cell models. NCATS just announced $17 million in grants to develop an entire human organ system over the next 3 years. Researchers at Columbia University are working on a project that would combine models of the heart, liver, and circulatory system. The scientists hope to test how well some drugs work on diseases of the heart and liver. At Harvard University, researchers are developing a tissue chip modeled on the heart and lungs. Together, the heart and lungs are part of the cardiopulmonary system. Both the heart and lungs are targets of some diseases. Many new drugs fail during the testing process because they may damage the heart. The Harvard researchers hope to create a cardiopulmonary system model that acts like a human system, both when it is diseased and in good working condition. Researchers say they can safely test the effects of a drug on different organ systems. They can use the tissue chips to observe a drug's effect on the organ or organs it is designed to target. Scientists want to make the process of developing drugs simpler. They hope the chips will help them find the safest and most successful drugs before human testing begins. And that's the VOA Learning English Technology Report. I'm Jonathan Evans.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to This is America. I'm Steve Ember. This week on our program, we explore a UNESCO World Heritage Site in the American Southwest near the city of Carlsbad, New Mexico. Carlsbad Caverns National Park contains more than 100 caves below the surface of the desert. Most are closed to the public, but anyone can visit the main attraction, one of the largest caves in the world. Huge, incredible, inspiring. Words like these come to mind as visitors enter a world of silence, darkness, and cold, almost 230 meters under the ground. Come along with us as Bob Doty and Barbara Klein tell you about Carlsbad Caverns.
An elevator lowers you into the world of Carlsbad Caverns, the big cave at Carlsbad Caverns National Park. Silent except for the voices of guides and visitors. And not completely dark, the National Park Service has enough lighting to see many of the beautiful formations all around. The temperature is about 13 degrees Celsius. A cavern is a large cave, but Carlsbad Cavern is really a long series of chambers. One of these is called the Big Room. The Big Room is more than 3 hectares big. The ceiling is 77 meters high. The Big Room is the single largest underground chamber ever found in North America.
The Big Room and other parts of the cavern contain huge, sharp formations of minerals. People are free to explore the lit formations in the Big Room, but park rangers must guide visitors to other areas of the cave. Stalactites hang from the ceiling. Stalagmites rise from the floor. Some even meet to create a column. Other formations look like needles, popcorn, pearls, and flowers. A visitor still remembers the memory aid she learned long ago from her fifth grade teacher. Stalactites have to hang on tight to the ceiling or they might fall off. And be careful about stalagmites. You might trip over one on the floor.
One of the first questions that visitors have is, how did Carlsbad Cavern form? Guides explain that it did not result from the action of water and streams like other limestone caves. Instead, it was created by the action of sulfuric acid. The limestone developed about 250 million years ago. Then, within the last 20 million years, movements in the earth pushed the rock upward, forming the Guadalupe Mountains. Today, these mountains extend from West Texas into southeast New Mexico. The action of oil and natural gas created hydrogen sulfide in the limestone. The hydrogen sulfide reacted with oxygen in rainwater moving through the rock. Sulfuric acid developed. The acid created the caves by dissolving the limestone in its path. Later, the water and most of the acid left the caves as the Guadalupe Mountains continued to rise. This permitted fresh water to move through. The fresh water left behind minerals. These minerals became the formations and shapes on the ceilings, walls, and floors of the caves.
people are not the only ones who visit Carlsbad Caverns National Park. About 400,000 Mexican free-tailed bats come to the Big Cave from Mexico each summer to give birth. Every evening, as the sun goes down, thousands of adult bats fly out of the natural entrance of the cave. It can take from 20 minutes to more than 2 hours for them all to leave. The bats fly to nearby river valleys to feed on night-flying insects. Then, toward morning, they return to the bat cave within Carlsbad Cavern. Park Service rangers explain that mother bats find their babies by remembering their location, their smell, and the sound of their cry. Mothers and pups hang in groups on the ceiling. They spend the day resting and feeding. While the adults go out at night for food, the young bats hang out in the cave for 4 or 5 weeks. Then, in July or August, they join their mothers on these nightly flights. Finally, in late October or early November, the bats all leave and return to Mexico. But they always return the next year.
It is easy to imagine that it was the bats that led ancient people to discover the cave. Archaeologists and others have found evidence of Ice Age hunters near the cave entrance. They have also found pieces of spear points left about 10,000 years ago. More recently, Apache Indians painted pictures at the entrance, and evidence of one of their cooking areas was found beside a nearby path. Around 1900, a teenage cowboy named James Larkin White began to explore the cave. Jim White told his story in the 1932 book, The Discovery and History of Carlsbad Caverns. Here is a reading of his description of his first sight of the bats and the big cave.
I thought it was a volcano, but then I'd never seen a volcano, nor never before had I seen bats swarm, for that matter. During my life on the range, I'd seen plenty of prairie whirlwinds, but this thing didn't move. It remained in one spot, spinning its way upward. I watched it for perhaps a half hour, until my curiosity got the better of me. Then I began investigating. I worked my way through the rocks and brush until I found myself gazing into the biggest and blackest hole I had ever seen, out of which the bats seemed literally to boil. The more I thought of it, the more I realized that any hole in the ground that could house such a gigantic army of bats must be a whale of a big cave. I crept between cactus until I lay on the brink of the chasm and looked down. During all the years I'd known of the place, I'd never taken the trouble to do this. There was no bottom in sight. I shall never forget the feeling of awness it gave me.
Jim White told how he built a ladder from rope, wire and sticks, and returned to the entrance of the cave a few days later.
I found myself climbing down, down, deeper and deeper into the blackness. At last, my feet touched something solid. I lighted my lantern and found that I was perched on a narrow ledge, almost at the end of my rope, literally and figuratively. By now, I could see into the tunnel. It wasn't much farther down to the floor of it, and that floor looked smooth and level. I decided that with a little exhibition of human fly stuff, I could hold on to the rough wall and go down another 20 feet to level territory. Standing at the entrance of the tunnel, I could see ahead of me a darkness so absolutely black it seemed a solid. The light of my lantern was but a sickly glow. Nevertheless, I forged ahead, and with each step the tunnel grew larger, and I felt as though I was wandering into the very core of the Guadalupe Mountains.
A few years later, a settler named Abijah Long also found the entrance and went into the cavern. He found huge amounts of bat droppings. Abijah Long hired local workers to mine the guano, which he sold to farmers as fertilizer. At the same time, he explored much of the caves. Some people might even say Abijah Long was the first real explorer of Carlsbad Cavern. But Jim White made it his life's work to make sure the public would see and enjoy the cavern. He worked on Abijah Long's mining operation for 20 years. The authors of the book, Carlsbad Cavern, The Early Years, say Jim White took the job for the chance to keep exploring the cave. And after the mining operation closed, he started building paths in the cavern. Yet once he had enough paths built to welcome visitors, no one seemed interested in his bat cave.
Then in 1918, Jim White took a professional photographer into the cave. Ray Davis's pictures of the big room appeared in the New York Times. National interest began to grow. In 1923, scientists from the National Geographic Society explored the caves. The following year, President Calvin Coolidge named Carlsbad a national monument. Presidents can declare national monuments, but Congress must act to establish a national park. And that is what Congress did in 1930.
Since then, parts of Carlsbad Caverns have been used for movie sets, weddings, even meetings of the Carlsbad City Council. Most visitors go to the main cavern, but some experienced cavers are permitted to explore 5 wild caves in the park. And in another one, scientists are studying microbes in search of a cure for cancer.
As for Jim White, he became chief ranger of Carlsbad Caverns. In his story, in the book The Discovery and History of Carlsbad Caverns, he talks about all the work that was done.
I doubt if you can understand how happy this modernizing has made me. It's like the pleasant end to a dream.
Our program was written by Nancy Steinbach and produced by Dana DeMange. I'm Bob Doty.
And I'm Barbara Klein. Doug Johnson was our reader.
This is America is a production of VOA Learning English. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us again next week.